and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge, one of the greatest to ever do it, Colin McFall of the mighty, the unbelievably, the godly Coxbar is on the show today. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to send me an email, you can head over to the email address, turnoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. There's also a Facebook page, and both of those are run by my brother and show producer, guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all your hard work, and he will get your message to me. If you want to contact me directly, you can find me on various forms of social media at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way of supporting the show is by telling everyone you know that you love this podcast. And also, you could subscribe to it, give it a 5-star review if you're listening to it on that podcast app that Apple does. Otherwise, just tell all your friends. Let everyone know that you enjoy this podcast, and we're out here doing it each and every week for your enjoyment, and they should check it out. And that's how you grow these things. That's how you make it bigger, you know? Just spread the word. Spread the word. Speaking of support, this thing would not be possible without the kind, loving support of the fine folks at Vans. Vans came aboard a few years ago and said, Damien, do what you do. Just don't do it out of your own pocket anymore. And they came on board in support of this thing, and it's been amazing ever since. They let me book whoever I want to book, and I just keep doing what I do. So thank you, everyone at Vans, and check out all the amazing House of Vans events popping up all the time. There's been some in Philadelphia recently. There was an amazing run of them in Chicago, a legendary run of shows in New York, or in Brooklyn, I should say. There's just so many of these great parties and so many great more podcasts that they support. So thanks, Vans. Thank you so much for doing it. You know, I really, really appreciate it. And speaking of appreciating, I got to appreciate all the amazing Patreon supporters that we have at the Turned Out a Punk Patreon. If you miss Footnotes, that's where Footnotes lives now. It's in Patreon land, and there's also other merch and things like that you can get. So just go over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. Support this thing. Allow me to keep doing it and to do it better, hopefully. Hopefully a little bit better. I got a new computer, which means I could keep doing it because the old computer died. So that would have been a disaster for trying to make podcasts without a computer. I don't think you can do it. It might be the one thing that you need to do a podcast. You don't need talent. You don't need any sort of skill set. You just need a computer. And so thank you to the patrons for allowing me to have one of those. So, and that's it. All right. On to today's show. Today on the show, huge guests. A huge shout out to our friends at Mutiny PR, the homie Vanessa. She reached out and said, would you like Colin from Coxbar on your podcast? And Tristan was like, abso-friggin-lutely. And I was like, holy shit. Cause this is one of those people that, you know, saw it all unfold right before their eyes. And from an amazing vantage point of being in one of the best punk bands ever. Like, if you are not familiar with this punk band, if you've just lumped them in as being, oh, they're just a street punk band, they're just a noise band, they're just this, they're just that. Listen to this band. They will blow your mind. Like, they have some songs, like just some of my favorite songs ever. And what an amazing opportunity this was. Unfortunately, there were some connection issues in the beginning, so it's a little shorter than I would have liked, but that just leaves more reason to have a part two, right? We all know that's how this thing goes. Like, spoiler alert, we're building up to the fact that I'm going to ask the person back for a part two. And believe me, there's lots more to get to. Oh, this is a good one. So I'm not going to ramble on anymore because this one's too good to waste time with an intro that goes on forever with, as I'm going on forever with this intro. So here is Colin McFall of the gods, Coxbar, on Turned Out a Punk. Colin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Damien, you're most welcome. Most welcome.
Well, as I was just relaying to you off air, you are a massive, massive influence on me. And your journey and your band's journey, I think, is sort of the perfect journey to kind of, you know, document on this show. So, I'm really excited, as you can hear.
There's no need to be. Just relax. Take some deep breaths. Go on.
Oh, I will. I will. Believe me. I'm going to get more excited as we go on, I assure you. But Colin, I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were performing as a band, if you like, you know, before punk started. Mm-hmm. We formed in 72, and I was 16 at that stage. You know, we've had the band ever since then. Mm-hmm. The first real exposure to it, I guess, was, I remember it vividly, actually. I mean, we were on tour with the Small Faces, who were like my favorite band of all time. This was in March. I'm crap with dates, right? So you have to check all this out. But March 77.
Okay.
And I heard the Jam single In the City. I was sitting waiting to go down to do a sound check or something, and I heard this song and I thought, fucking hell, that is different. And it also evolved from there. I mean, there was all the Pistols things going on in West London, which hadn't yet sort of really materialized. Mm-hmm. But I remember vividly at the end of that Small Faces tour, we were, because we were signed to a record label, every record label had to have a number of punk bands.
Okay.
You know? And I'm doing the finger thing, you know, I know you can't see it, but they didn't really care what it was, but they had to have within their roster, they had to have a number of punk bands. And the label that we were signed to, there was us, Slaughter and the Dogs, and Adam and the Ants. The problem we had was that we didn't really buy into all the punk thing. I mean, for us, punk has always been attitude rather than fashion, but one of our very first meetings with a record company around this time, they said, you know, punk's the next big thing. And we said, well, what do you want us to do differently? And they said, well, you got to wear these clothes. We said, well, no, we're not going to wear those clothes. That's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And it sort of went on from there. And we've been sort of, you know, bashing heads with some people's perception of what punk is ever since that day. And that in itself, we sit around and talk about it, that in itself seems to be quite, you know, a punk ethos way to go about things, you know. We don't necessarily, to this day, we still don't do things that we don't want to do. We still don't agree with things we don't want to agree with. And so our first initial exposure to it was being told, you've got to do this, and us telling them to fuck off. So that's you know, it's stayed that way ever since, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah, and I think the other thing is, you know, your attitude is what informs punk's attitude, because, you know, like, you're the band that kind of everyone follows in a lot of ways too. Like, you know, and this is the ethos that you kind of put forth, the fashion you kind of put forth, like, even though the anti-fashion in this case,
yeah,
it really inspires, you know, bands going forward from there. But like, what inspired, you know, yourselves? It's, you know, obviously the age of 16, you're pretty young, but to start the band at that age?
It was a school thing, like, you know, like a lot of bands. We wanted to get girls. That was the easiest way to do it, or so we thought. We weren't particularly successful at it. But it was, in the UK at the time, it was sort of early 70s, 72. So it was T-Rex, it was Slade, it was Bowie, it was all that glam rock stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of stuff that we were playing at the time. That was our influences from sort of 72 onwards. We've always been first and foremost a bunch of mates, you know, just a group of pals hanging around having a beer. So even in those days, that's what it was, without any great ambition for the future or, you know, the best way to go forward. So we never really planned anything. We just tried to copy the songs that we saw on TV, you know, and some of the styles of bands that we saw on TV, and it wasn't very successful, to be honest. I mean, we weren't meant to be a glam rock band, as simple as that.
Yeah.
Although people do say that you can hear that influence in some of the songs, you know, from particularly the early stuff, I guess, the early recordings.
Well, yeah, going to the early stuff, like right off the bat, were you guys doing originals or was it covers in the early years?
No, covers at first. Yeah, I mean, always covers. We used to play at a youth club down in East London. And, you know, I say I was 16, the other lads were a year older than me, so they were 17. And there was a girls' school just across the road from where we used to play. Mm-hmm. And on a Friday night, you know, we'd get a couple hundred people in this place. And we were doing all those songs. You know, we did Under My Wheels by Alice Cooper. We did Gene Genie by Bowie. We did all, you know, all those sorts of things, from Slade and T-Rex and Sweet and that sort of stuff, because they were the songs that everybody knew.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only, I don't know, probably a couple of years after that, that we started to write our own stuff. Didn't always do anything with it, to be honest. I mean, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks back, and we were talking about Shock Troops, and Shock Troops just sort of rolled out, if you can imagine. When we got an invitation to record the album back in, whenever it was, 82 or something, all these songs had been pent up and held in, and it took us about, you know, a week to get the whole thing started and finished, just because they'd been there from that early time.
So that's what I was going to ask. Like, is that early stuff that you guys are writing, is that, you know, where the band would be sound-wise, you know, a few years later?
Say that again.
Like, those early songs that you're writing, those are the songs that would kind of make up the early stuff that you guys were recording?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. And but, I mean, you have to understand, there are so many rubbish songs that no one's ever going to get to hear. You know, I mean, our sixth member of the band, Will, who's our road manager, is my oldest friend. You know, he said to me that I've got this reel-to-reel tape of one of the first rehearsals that you guys did. He said, and it's toe curling. He said, and one of these days, if you don't treat me properly, I'm going to bring it out, and I'm going to, you know, let the world listen to it. So yeah, so some of those songs were awful. You know, we used to play at the Marquee Club in London. We used to have a friend who was the sort of the booker there, and he used to put us on any support slot he had that he hadn't filled already. And we used to support some you know, great bands of the day, and we used to just play this dross, you know, this really cliched, horrible type stuff, you know. So it was all a learning your trade, you know. It was all, you know, rites of passage type thing. But we got there in the end.
What informed those early lyrics? Like, what was, you know, because, like, you know, you say you're the sound, you know, you can hear the glam kind of influence there, but the lyrics are decidedly not like Alice Cooper.
No, I mean, a lot of those early songs were written by Burge, the bass player, and Steve's, you know, Steve, if you talk to Burge about songwriting, he doesn't necessarily want to talk to you about the melody or the middle eights or the choruses. You know, it's the lyrical content that he is particularly proud of, and a lot of those songs are stories, and you know, they're true things that we happened across or we encountered. Or, you know, Sunday Stripper is, we used to go to this pub every Sunday and watch the girls dance. You know, it was as simple as that. We came home and wrote a song about it. You know, Riot Squad, we knew a guy that we was at school with that if you like, defected to the other side and became a member of the police force. And Riot Squad was written about that guy. And so it was, you know, there's a lot of the songs that we've written are actual true life, you know, true life stories that we've encountered, or we've come across.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it's authentically street rock and roll, and that's what it's labeled as, street rock and roll. But it is,
yep.
You know, it's one of the first times in a long time at that point, I guess, that music was kind of coming from a real reality perspective again.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you can only write so many love songs, can't you?
Yeah.
You know, you've got to write things about, you write songs about what you know and people you've met and stories you can tell. And I think the one thing about Cock Sparrow is, you know, that's always been the case, that you can go through any of our albums and pick out most of the songs, and most of those songs, we have a story about them, and we'll tell you the history to them and where they came from and who those people were and that sort of stuff. I mean, some we won't, because some of them are a secret, you know. Some of them are our observations about people that we don't particularly want to, you know, come across again. So, you know, we'll write a song about them, but we won't give him the glory of saying this song's about you, fella, you know, so.
Absolutely. So yeah. Were bands like, you know, the Pink Fairies and the Deviants, were they had influences at all? Or was that kind of like a completely separate world?
The Pink Fairies is one of Steve Bruce's favorite bands.
Okay.
He phoned me the other day. Again, he was talking about fairies wear boots and things like this, and I haven't got a clue what he's talking about. But he was very heavily into all that sort of stuff. I mean, things like the MC5 never really crossed the Atlantic at that time, as far as we were concerned.
Yeah,
I mean, our influences were people, you know, bands like Humble Pie, you know, because Marriott was, you know, such a great singer. and people like that. I mean, when we first started, it was only 3 years after Woodstock, which is what people don't sort of appreciate. And punk was only sort of, you know, 8 years after Woodstock. So it was a huge, turn of events and a change in times.
Were there like any crossovers between the scene that you kind of were playing towards? Like, obviously you're playing with the Small Faces ultimately, but like in the pub rock stuff that was happening, like Dr. Feelgood and all those bands?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we used to go and see Feelgood all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever played with them, to be honest, but there was a really healthy sort of London pub circuit where you could go out 7 nights a week if you wanted to. There were always good bands out there, you know, guaranteed to give you a good night out.
Yeah.
I mean, where we lived in Eastern London, there were three or four pubs where it would just be dedicated to music the whole week through. And we would just pick our nights and go down and either watch a really good covers band, or if, you know, someone else, you know, someone like the Feelgoods were playing, you know, we go down and see them and that sort of thing. But there was never any crossover in terms of us being in the band and them being in the band. We were much too insignificant for that.
No, but I meant just like, were you guys playing with like Brinsley Schwartz and all those kind of bands, or is that?
No, again, no of them, but I don't think our paths ever crossed. I mean, you know, we played with bands like Status Quo. This is some weird names, but again, where we live, there was a pub that put on bands every weekend, and we quite often get a call to go down there and open up the show for that particular night. So, you know, we played with Motorhead down there when they first formed.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we played with, you know, Manfred Mann's Earth Band. And it didn't really matter who – it was a gig for us. It was like a paid rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't really matter whether we were a fit for the main band or not. And it didn't really matter whether it was Motorhead or Manfred Mann. It was just like an opportunity for us to get out and play and maybe make some new friends, you know.
And what a way to kind of cut your chops as a live band is having.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And we met some guys, you know, doing that who influenced the way that we behave as well, because we remember being treated really well by some of these bands, and we remember being treated really poorly by some of these bands.
Mm-hmm.
And that has sort of influenced the way that we now behave to other bands that are on the bill when we play. Mm-hmm. You know, we try to give them as much help and assistance as we can if they need it, you know, if they want it. But you know, we met some right arseholes in our time, but it was just, as you say, it was just learning your trade.
Yeah. Like, I'm always fascinated by kind of like that punk explosion, ultimately the new wave kind of thing that happens, like scene that there would have been in London. Like, was it mainly just sort of disparate pub scenes, kind of bands playing together, or did you feel part of any sort of larger band community at that time?
We certainly never felt part of any community or anything at all. We were almost by our own decision, really. We were out on a limb.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of this was happening in West London.
Mm-hmm.
And we were well and truly out to the east side of town. So while we were happy with doing our own little thing around there, all the press and all the publicity was being centered around, you know, what was happening with bands like the Pistols and the Clash and people like that, completely away from where we were operating.
I guess going back before this, how did you get into music yourself? Like, did you grow up in a household where, you know, was it like a music loving household, or did you kind of hear it through the radio?
Yeah, no, I have two older brothers and an older sister. And, you know, my upbringing was listening to Tamla Motown and the early Stax stuff and Aretha Franklin and people like that. I mean, my brother is just slightly older than me. He has the most fantastic Tamla 7-inch vinyl collection, because every Friday when he got paid from work, he would go out and buy the latest Tamla single that came out, and all Friday night we'd be subjected to listening him play it on his dance set with the arm off, you know, so it would just play on repeat all the time and time and time. So, you know, so by the end of the night, I knew every word to Ball of Confusion. You know, it was just one of those things, you know. But yeah, I mean, grew up with that. My oldest brother was a mod, and you know, he had the Moët suits and the Parkers and the Vespa GS, you know, and although they weren't technically musical, it was always a musical household.
Yeah.
My dad used to sing in the pubs and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, that's probably why I'm a singer, because I was too lazy to learn an instrument.
So you said your dad sings as well?
He did when he was alive, bless him. Yeah. He used, yeah. I mean, when I remember being a kid and being taken down to the sit outside the pub with a packet of chips and a lemonade, and you could hear him on the mic murdering some song inside, you know. So whatever particular song that was, he was ruining that one, you know.
So where did you kind of go when you went to music yourself? Was it just through, you know, stuff you were hearing on the radio? Like, why did you pick sort of the more glammy stuff that was happening at that time?
Really, because that's the best of what was happening. I mean, it was almost accessible. You could go and see. I mean, you had the bands like Led Zeppelin, who were, you know, by far the biggest band of the time. Mm-hmm. And every time they rolled into town, you'd probably go and see them. But stuff that we could really relate to was all the glam stuff, because that was, again, in itself, as was punk, that was something that was totally different. Because no one had ever seen anything like that before, you know, with the platform shoes and the glitter jackets and the star eyeliner and stuff, you know. It was all new, and it was stuff that your parents hated. Yeah. as much as they hated punk stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Punk had no respect, and you know, these glam bands, you know, they were just dressed like something your dad wouldn't like. So, you know, straight away you aligned yourself to it because it pissed off your parents.
Do you remember the first time you came across like glam music?
I don't, to be honest, not specifically. I mean, it was just a general tide of things in, you know, from around 71 onwards, really, right up until 75, I guess. And then we had a couple of years of things like the Stylistics and the Philly Sound and all this sort of stuff. And then punk came along and kicks everybody up the ass.
It kind of makes sense too, because, like, you know, your band's sound is ultimately, like, you know, the two influences kind of coming together.
I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. People have said that before.
Yeah, like it really, you know, and I guess, you know, once again, it's a sound that would go on to become defined as punk, but you're, you know, ultimately creating it before punk is defined itself. But it really is like, you know, once again, it's that return to kind of like, you know, real music in a weird way, even though glam is once again so fantastical.
It's great. I mean, everything got lumped in, you know, to the punk genre. Mm-hmm. You know, if you listen to stuff by the Buzzcocks, I mean, beautiful, beautiful songs, beautiful lyrics, you know, great melodies, great stories, not played at a million miles an hour. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Buzzcocks got called a punk band. But it's just because it was easy for them to be categorized as such with everybody else. You know, if you listen to the Pistols stuff, the Pistols weren't playing at Ramones speed. Mm-hmm. The Ramones played at Ramones speed. Nobody else did.
Well, even in the Ramones in the beginning didn't play at Ramones.
No, speed. Exactly. And at the end, they certainly did.
Yeah, at the end, they certainly speeded up. Yeah. Oh my gosh, a frightening speed at sometimes. But what was the first concert you remember going to, other than your father?
Oh my goodness. I don't honestly know. I can't pick out one. It would have been one of the local pubs in, I mean, at the time you had to be, well, you still do actually, 18 to get in and drink in a pub. Mm-hmm. But we used to go down there at 15 and 16. It was probably one of the local pubs, like the Bridge House, or there was a pub called the World's End, which was in Forest Gate, Hackney Way, that sort of way. We used to go down there and watch bands as well. And it was really just a case of us trying to sneak in unnoticed, get a beer and keep quiet and watch the bands. You know, the same way as you used to try to do when you was 15, try to get into an X-rated movie. You get to the same thing. You hope you get in and hope no one noticed you and, you know, realize you was only 15 years old.
Yeah, just play it cool and no one will see it's a kid.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it was our main thing. We used to do it all the time. As I said earlier, we had the guy that works on the back door at the Marquee Club in Soho in London, and we used to give him a special knock on the door and he'd open it up and let us in for nothing and that sort of thing. So we saw loads and loads of bands, all of whom, I guess, in one way or another, turned out to be, you know, influences in some way, shape or form.
Mm-hmm. Were there any bands at the time that you remember particularly liking that you got to see around then? You know, even bands that didn't wind up recording or going on to anything major.
I still maintain to this day, when asked the question, what was your favorite ever gig? I saw AC/DC on their first ever tour.
Oh, yeah.
Play at the Marquee Club in London. Never seen anything like it. You know, with Bon Scott, they were they just blew us all away. We just all stood there with our, you know, with our mouths open. Jeez, this is fantastic, you know. And the Marquee was such a place that, you know those clubs you go into where the carpet has got so ruined over the years that your feet stick to it and you can't move and that sort of thing. Well, it was like that.
Yes.
It was like a shower running off the ceiling with a sweat, you know. And there was Angus and Bon Scott, you know. Angus was on Bon Scott's shoulders and you know, he was walking in amongst the crowd. It was just without a doubt the best gig I'd seen up until then, and I'm still waiting to find one that takes its place now.
Well, I guess speaking of amazing sort of gigs, did you see the Dolls, New York Dolls, when they came over the first time?
I didn't. No, again, Steve Bruce, our drummer, very big New York Dolls fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Steve definitely went to see them. And again, it was almost after the effect, because, I mean, that was across to us. That was a late arrival on the glam scene.
Mm-hmm.
So although we could appreciate what the Dolls were doing, it was just before that period, just before punk.
Mm-hmm.
So the glam stuff had finished. So we thought, oh, he's an American band who want to jump on the glam bandwagon.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously that wasn't the case.
Were there labels or recording contract opportunities before Decca for the band?
No, even Decca wasn't an opportunity, really. If we're honest, we were signed to Decca because our manager, I'm doing that thing with the fingers again. Our manager had an artist who was with that label who had a number one single, so he almost got us on there. On the back of this other guy's success,
okay,
and tried to tailor us into the punk band thing that Decca wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the story was quite ironic that Daryl, our rhythm guitarist now, is his dad who worked at Decca, actually signed us to the label.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah, I know, an incredible coincidence. I mean, when we first came to the States in 2000 and played in CBGBs, Daryl's dad flew out and came to the gig. And we know him from somewhere. Where do we know him from? You know, who is this? He's so familiar. And it was Daryl's dad who worked the record label at the time.
Oh my gosh, that's like
I know,
confluence,
full circle.
Going back before, I guess you got signed to Decca. There was a time where, you know, you were approached by Malcolm McLaren, right?
Yeah, true.
Was that like, was there a point where you felt like the band was going to sign with him, or is that just something that's been kind of hyped?
No. It was quite a brief meeting. It was literally a case of, we heard that, you know, this thing, you know, with the Sex Pistols was going on. It was being formulated almost.
Mm-hmm.
And a bass player, Burge, and one of our roadies at the time went up to the King's Road and said to McLaren, look, if you want the real McCoy, you got to come and see this band.
Mm-hmm.
And to his credit, you know, he came from West London to East London and watched us play a rehearsal in a upstairs of a pub. But, you know, McLaren came in with this guy who had spurs and bondage trousers. And once we'd all stopped laughing, you know, we said, what are we doing? You know, what's going on here? And, you know, again, McLaren said, you know, I'd like to come and support this band, this new band I'm putting together, you know, and we'll see how it goes from there. And, you know, we tell the story about he didn't get his round of drinks in, you know, so that was the end of it. I mean, it wasn't quite like that, but I mean, that was certainly a true element. It was, you know, we sat there parched, having played three of these worst possible songs to the guy who was going to run the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
And you could tell he wasn't impressed. Mm. And then the end said, well, look, this clearly ain't going to work. I mean, you know, we ain't going to dress up like this clown here. You know, we're here in our Dr. Martens and in our jungle greens, and that's all we've ever done. That's all we're ever going to do. And so we agreed to not take it any further.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to the realness, right? Like what you're talking about is very much, you know, put on kind of thing.
You know, you never plan these things. And, you know, there are people who try to be awkward and try to be difficult. We were just so wrongly, if you like, self-centered that we didn't care about what anybody else thought.
Mm-hmm.
We just thought, this is what's best for us. And you know, we were five, six mates, and that was it. And we were never going to do anything that jeopardized that. And even if somebody had said off that, like, I really think we should give this guy the time of day, it was never going to happen. Because it was so removed from the way that we were naturally, that we were never going to, you know, dress up for anybody or put on a show or put on a fake accent or, you know, be something we're not. And it's something we've always tried to maintain even to this day. You know, if you come see Cockspur now, it's we're the same people that we were all those years ago.
Mm-hmm. Once again, though, I think it comes back to the songs, right? Like, I think that's why your band does survive the test of time, is because
without a doubt.
You know, what were the big, you know, turning points you feel as a band songwriting? Like, what to you are the songs that stand out?
Well, you have to understand that when we recorded Shock Troopers, which is in about 82, mm-hmm. The story behind that is that we were given the money to record England Belongs to Me as a single. And we hadn't written England Belongs to Me. And Stephen Berger got into this record company and goes, we've got this great song called England Belongs to Me. And the guy goes, great, I love it. You know, write it and we'll record it and we'll give you some money for it. So they then had to go away and write the song. So they sold the idea on the title alone. So then they had to go home and Berger wrote the song and went back in. The guy said, yeah, I like it. I'll record it. Here's X amount of money. And with that money, we recorded Shock Troops, unbeknown to the record company. And we had all this in the bag, if you like. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, okay, I'd like to hear England now. And we said, yeah, there's England. And we've also got this 12-inch. And the guy went, well, when did you record that? We said, well, at the same time, because we did it in about a week or something. All of those songs on that album are songs that we play now because people can relate in some way to those songs, or they mean something to them, or they've influenced them in some way, or they just like to sing along with the catchy hooks and choruses, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's all about the songs, and also, I dare say, our ability to still deliver those songs, because we've always said when we can't do that anymore, and that's when we'll stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want to come and hear those songs, but they want to come and hear those songs played well. And then if we can't do that anymore, then we won't do it. Simple as that.
Well, I think it's also being authentic and being real, you know, like, the band is, you know, like everyone I know that's worked with you, everyone I know that's played with you, you know, speaks, you know, about how, you know, it's still that band, you know, it's still like a real thing. It's not just a bunch of guys putting on an act, you know, for a paycheck.
You know, the way we do it, there's six of us, there's five in the band. And as I say, there's Will, who takes care of our roadie and stuff and things like that. And someone's paying for us to go somewhere in the world and sing some songs and put us in a hotel and us to have some fun and, you know, meet some new friends. You know, that's fantastic. That's the best possible story you can tell. I mean, there's no airs and graces about us. You know, we say to people, the most awkward thing we've had to do recently, I'll tell you this, it's really weird, is like, you know, these signings you do?
Yeah.
We did one at Riot Fest the other day, and it was nice. I mean, the guy was great and, you know, made these brilliant posters and things like that. But it's so awkward for us.
Yeah.
Because we were just going to say, well, look, I've got a case of beer here. Come and sit down and tell me how your day's been. You know, tell me about your family and this sort of stuff. And we would much rather do that than mm-hmm. a great big long line of people saying sign next. You know, we're just not into that really. That's not us. So it's right. We are the same people we've always been, and we will maintain that. And there've been many a times when someone has stepped out of line or one of us has got delusions above their station or whatever, and they've had a severe slapping down from the rest of us. You know, we say, listen, whoa, we don't do that. You know, that's not like us. Yeah, you know, we don't, you know, we saw it. I mean, I don't know if you saw it or not, but we stuck something on our Instagram page the other day of the bus that we used when we was at Riot Fest, and it was like the fucking happy bus. You know, it was all full of graffiti and shit next to all these nightliners that all the other bands turned up in, you know. And that to us is hilarious. That's the sort of thing we really like doing. You know, we don't need to all that posing. We're not like that.
Going back to that tour with the Small Faces, like, what did they make of the kind of changing shape of music that was kind of happening at the time, or the changing face of music? Like, were they cool to you guys? And who wasn't even in the lineup at that point?
It was the original lineup apart from Ronnie Lane.
Yeah.
It was Marriott, Ian McLagan, Kenny Jones, P.P. Arnold. And I had Rick Wills, who I think played in Foreigner later on, or was in Foreigner at the time. I think Rick Wills played bass on that tour. Lovely fella.
Okay.
they took to us really well. I mean, this was a comeback thing for them, so they were doing their greatest hit show as such, which all the crowd, that's all they wanted to hear. But they were so gracious to us. It was unbelievable. And, you know, these were my heroes. I mean, again, another story is we turned up at the first gig on the first night, pulled into the car park, and we had a big old red diesel GPO van, you know, that post office van. And that's what we used. And you could hear it coming for about a mile away before it actually arrived, you know, before you saw it. That and the clouds of smoke that this thing threw out. And we pulled into the car park, and they had these two 40-foot trailers, you know, and they said, "So what, you're coming on tour with us in that?" And we went, "Well, yeah." And they said, "No, I don't think so." We said, "Well, why not? You know, it goes, it's all right, you know, it's cheap." And they said, "What have you got?" We said, "We've got 2 4x12 cabinets and a couple of amps and some drums down there wrapped in blankets." They haven't got any cases, but wrapped in blankets. The guy said, "Stick them on the back of our truck." Really? He went, yeah. Take your red van home, because that won't make it around the UK, and you can just come in with us. So we did. So we did 2 weeks on the road with them, on their bus, you know, with their roadies umping our gear in and out all over the place.
That's very amazing.
Gracious. Yeah, very gracious, very nice people. For first night we were there, the dressing room door opened. They came in with this kitchen tray with a mountain of cocaine, and we went. They said, "Welcome to the tour." We went, "Actually, we don't, you know, because we were on our asses from East End of London. We, you know, we were signing on. We had no money. We hadn't seen cocaine." And we said, "We don't do drugs." And they went, "Really?" We said, "No." He said, "Well, thank you very much." I said, "More for us." And out they went again. That, you know, that's how it was. But no, but very kind, very nice. You know, some people bring you cupcakes, and they brought us cocaine.
That is the most small faces thing I think I can imagine happening. So yeah. I don't know, somehow fitting in a sad way.
All good. All good. Yeah, all good.
Where, other than the Jam, were there other bands that you kind of felt, like eventually you wind up on Razor Records, obviously, but were there other bands that you felt eventually that were more kind of in line with what you were thinking, not approaching this as a way of just dressing up?
There were lots of bands that we loved. I mean, The Clash is still one of my favourite bands. I mean, although, you know, they were, in the nicest possible way, like a manufactured band. You know, they were a boy band. They were put together as the Pistols were, you know. But still, you can't decry what they achieved. You know, fantastic songs and albums and performances. So no, I mean, it's not really until you had almost a second wave, we had bands like the Cockney Rejects coming on who were the real deal as far as we were concerned. You know, there was a lot of stuff that was in that first wave of punk that was almost bandwagon jumping. It was almost like anybody can do it. And that was the spirit of the whole thing, of course, was that, you know, as the saying of the time was, you know, three chords, right? There you go. You're in a punk band. That's how it was. There weren't many of them that we actually liked, to be honest. There aren't many other albums I've got today. I mean, I've got all the Clash stuff, obviously, and I've got all the Pistol stuff and things like that. But I mean, there were lots of bands that we never crossed paths with, and there were lots of bands who came and went, you know, within the blink of an eye. But so there were a lot of shit bands, but there were also some classic bands that came out around that time. And I mentioned the Buzzcocks again, just for their songwriting ability. You know, X-Ray Specs, brilliant, you know, brilliant songs, brilliant, brilliant songs.
Yeah, like who would you, in that sort of first wave of bands, because like, you know, as you're saying, like when Cockney Rejects and that second wave of bands kind of show up, I can picture the flyers with yourselves on it, but who would you find yourselves playing with in that sort of first wave of bands?
Well, we never played with the Clash, we never played with the Pistols. We played with the Jam, we played with Chelsea. Never played with the Buzzcocks, never played with Gen X. We weren't liked, basically. Yeah, we're coming to the same conclusion here. No one wanted us on board at all.
Yeah, well, like, you know, is it once again, like you're saying, like it seems like, you know, from what you're describing and, you know, things I've obviously put together myself before this, that first wave, it's very much still like a fashion thing, it's still getting figured out. And then in the second wave, it gets much more kind of codified into something new.
Yeah. I mean, there were bands that came out of that first tranche, if you like, that went on to do great things like Susie and the Banshees. You know, they developed their own style.
Yeah.
You know, and were very successful. So they obviously had some legs. But there are a lot of bands that fell by the wayside that were just faff and no substance, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever play with the Desperate Bicycles? Just out of curiosity.
No, okay. I don't think so.
One of the more obscure bands, I guess, from that first wave of bands.
Yeah. No, the name doesn't ring a bell.
When you started touring out and going across, like, when was the first time that you got to Europe, or mainland Europe, I should say?
That would have been after the Astoria gig, which was in about 93, I think. You have to forgive me. I'm terrible with dates.
The comeback 92, gig?
Yeah,
the comeback
gig? The comeback gig, yeah, the Astoria one, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, after I remember vividly, we played that gig, and we were sitting upstairs having a quick beer and a sandwich. I remember talking to a guy called Arthur from the Lurkers, and he said, you should go to Europe. And we said, well, why would you want to go to Europe? Who's going to know us in Europe? People don't know us in London, for fuck's sake, what? And he said, no, you should go to Europe. It's really good fun. It's a really great scene, et cetera, et cetera. So it just happened that we were approached by a small German label to do an album,
mm-hmm.
Which was Guilty as Charged. And we toured on the back of that. And it was an eye opener. It was fantastic. I mean, we did 14 dates in 16 days. I think we played about four or five bona fide clubs. The rest were sort of squats and someone's garden and school halls and things like that. But it was a brilliant experience. We still talk about it now. So real good fun.
Sorry, before you got back together, then, did you have any sort of appreciation of kind of like the cult around the band that had been kind of growing?
No, we had no idea.
Oh, wow.
And that's the honest truth. We were approached to do the Astoria gig,
mm-hmm.
and we said, are you mad? Well, why would you want to do that? He said, oh, I think people would be interested. And he said, I'll pay you, whatever it was now, 300 quid. And we went, well, okay, well, it'll be a story to tell our grandchildren or whatever, some later stage. But, you know, you're going to lose your money, my friend. And the Astoria gig was put on. It was us and the Addicts and a few other bands as well. Splodge, I think, and Daryl's original band. I think the Elite played as well. Anyway, so it was the first experience ever of us turning up and people knowing the songs.
Mm.
And the one thing that we've tried to engender since then really is that people come along and join in and make it their party, make it their night. So, you know, there will be people leaving the shows who can't talk because their voices are hoarse. And that's the first time we experienced that. They knew every word to every song that we played, which was really helpful because we didn't know most of them. we sort of flapped our way through it. And oh yeah, of course, it's the mid late there when the crowd started singing it. But it was, you know, it was sold out, and we genuinely didn't expect that to happen. And that was a surprise. And because what happened in the meantime between us recording and releasing Shock Troops and that gig, we'd played a few shows here and there, but it was all trouble and too much and places were getting smashed up and we thought someone's going to get hurt. So we decided, listen, this is just not worth it. I looked around my group of friends and said, look, I don't want to play a show where you're going to get bottled or glassed or whatever. So you know what? We don't need this. And I think it was during that period of time that Shock Troops grew into this sort of cult thing,
mm-hmm.
if you can, you know, and people knew the songs. And so I think when it was announced that Coxsparrow were going to play again at the Astoria, they came from all over the world. It was a very humbling experience, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just talking to a friend of mine right now, and I was telling him I was going to be talking to you, and he was like, tell him I was at the comeback show. And he was. He's not just lying. I promise. He was there.
15,000 people were at the comeback show, apparently.
Exactly.
In fact, we were so poorly rehearsed at the afternoon of that show, because Steve Bruce, our drummer, had a pub at the time in London, and it was about a couple of miles away from the story. So we said, we still don't know these bloody songs. So we said, okay, what we'll do is we'll go down the pub and we'll rehearse them lunchtime. The pub's quiet. There's no one around. Because the word got out and there were like 200 or 300 people waiting for us to do this thing. Now, if you talk to anybody now, yeah, I was at the pub. You couldn't have been at the pub because that makes 5,000 people in the pub on a Sunday lunchtime. That's never going to happen. Yeah, I was there. I was definitely there.
Well, he did not claim to be at the pub. He's not making that bold of a claim. But
he was at the Astoria, though, right?
He was claiming he was at the Astoria with the guy from Bitscore Records, no less. So,
no, really,
a small world indeed.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
So what exactly do you think changed in 92 that made it so different from, like, you know, 83? Like, what did change that allowed shows to kind of happen? Like, why the violence subsided, do you think?
I think everybody got a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And I think people had perhaps different responsibilities, and it wasn't the thing they had to do every week. Mm-hmm. There was a period where, you know, punk shows are quite unhealthy. You know, there would be violence, and as well as all the spitting and stuff that was, you know, just horrible. And I think what happened in the meantime was just that people grew up somewhat. Mm-hmm. I mean, you still saw it occasionally. I mean, we still had rows. We still put our guitars down and jumped off stage on more than one occasion. But, you know, it was nowhere like it was that first time around.
Coming back, you know, in 92, and then ultimately kind of when you came back, like, you know, does it surprise you at kind of the impact the band has had? Like, you know, like there's bands that sound very much influenced by yourselves today. And, like, I think you'd have no problem finding a scene to fit in with these days.
Yeah. I mean, we find it all quite, not embarrassing. Embarrassing is the wrong word. We find it all quite humbling, really. And, mm-hmm. and we never lose sight of the fact of who we are. So we still pinch ourselves on more than one occasion. You know, you'll find yourself doing something and you think, is it really me here doing this, you know, playing to all these people? And this, you know, you play to, you know, 15,000 people somewhere in a field, and you think they've come to see us, you know.
Yeah.
And then you feel a level of responsibility, and then that makes you even more anxious, and, you know, you want to make it right and things like this. But we've never taken that for granted, you know, and we've never turned up and just gone through the motions. That's not the way we do things. You know, we are, you know, totally dedicated to making it as best a possible show as we can. Mm-hmm. And we want to, you know, make the songs the ones songs that people want to hear. We've tried to change the set so many times and bring songs back into the set that maybe we haven't played for a while. But the reason they're not in the set is because they don't go down well. They're not as well liked, yeah, you know. Yeah. So it's like a catch-22. I remember one occasion, we always start with Riot Squad. And, you know, as soon as the intro finishes and Mickey starts playing Riot Squad, you know, the place goes up and the beer flies and we're off. You know, it's another party night. Mm-hmm. One night we decided, no, we'll change it. We'll start with something else. And there was this guy who had turned up, had seen us lots of times and was there with his girlfriend, and he was boasting to her about how well he knows us and things like this. And he said, I'll tell you one thing, you know, they'll start with Riot Squad, then they'll do this. And of course we didn't, and we started with Running Riot or something. And she said, oh, I thought you knew this band. You know, and he came and found us afterwards and said, you bastards, you know, you probably let me down here because, you know, I was telling her, you know, I knew everything about you, but then so you can't win.
You cannot win.
You can't. So if you try and change it for the right reasons, and then you can upset somebody. So
you're going to start a domestic squabble.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, given that the band, you know, like, you know, you've been around for so many different waves of whatever this music is, like, be it glam, be it punk, be it oi, yeah, like, where do you define Coxbar?
I never do. I try not to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the thing that the genre, if you like, that I think best summed us up was sort of street punk. Mm-hmm. I never really got the oi thing too much, because that tended to get a little bit sidetracked by other issues.
Yeah.
Punk is punk. To me, punk is an ethos. It's not about necessarily about the music or about the clothes. It's about state of mind to me. And, you know, anybody can get up and do it, and they're more than welcome to do so. And you haven't got to be brilliant. You've just got to be, you know, dedicated to what you do. So, you know, for me, it's not necessarily anything to do with the image that you're creating. It's about just being who you are. Mm-hmm. And that's always been the most important thing to us.
Colin, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the show. At some point in the future, would you come on for a part 2 or something?
Yeah, love to, Damon. No problem at all. Love the questions. I mean, we get used to answering questions like, you know, why is there a big P in Cox Sparrow, and you know, what's your favorite color? So, you know, this has really been interesting, and yeah, thank you for doing the research beforehand. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Colin, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, there's plenty of room for a part two. So Colin will be back for a part two in the near future, because we got a lot more to talk about. We got a lot more to get to. But speaking of getting to things, next week on the show, we got to get to another guest from England, you know, from the UK. Next week on the show, we're a bit of a departure, though. There's someone that no doubt is also a revolutionary in their field, someone that was a great builder in their chosen field, and once again, someone that does come from punk rock, but this is one of those ones that dovetails with my other love, pro wrestling. Next week on the show, Jim Smallman, the one of the people that helped resurrect British wrestling. Like, we talk about this, the UK wrestling scene was dead, and Jim and a bunch of incredibly talented wrestlers and other bookers basically brought it back and made it a vibrant scene, but Jim Smallman says that it was all thanks to the influence of punk rock that led him to do this. And he actually founded Progress Wrestling, which has branded itself punk rock wrestling, and has recently turned his back on that and announced that he's going to be leaving Progress to work for the major label in pro wrestling, like the major label in pro wrestling, the WWE. This is a fascinating conversation, not just about pro wrestling, but just about following your dreams and working towards your dreams and the power of punk rock. Like, this is the type of show that this podcast was meant for, you know, like these sorts of episodes. I've wanted to have Jim on this thing since I started this podcast, long before I ever met him. And so the fact that it's finally happening, it's another one ticked off my checklist, my personal checklist that, you know, I'm still keeping score. Still keeping score for myself. So that is next week on the show. One of my most wanted guests, Jim Smallman, on Turned Out of Punk. Well, that's it, everyone. Thank you very much for listening. Go out there and sign your organ donor cards. Tell all your friends about this podcast. Go and make your own culture, because anyone can do this shit. And that's it. Stay safe, and I will see you all next week.